I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we have a different kind of show, one that marks the 60th birthday of the ACLU of Indiana. For nearly 6 years, I was executive director of the Indiana ACLU, and I'm joined by several other members of that small club, former executive directors Sheila Kennedy and Gil Holmes, and current executive director Jane Henniger. We'll talk about what the ACLU is, where it's been, and where it's going. Please join this conversation within the clubhouse walls by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We look forward to talking with you. Now, this news.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. Today we have a special program. We are marking the 60th anniversary of the ACLU of Indiana. I probably should start this program with a disclosure of sorts and acknowledge that I was the executive director of what was then the Indiana Civil Liberties Union, but is now ACLU of Indiana, for almost 6 years. And I am joined today by other members of that rather small club. I think there have only been about six or seven of us total in the history of the organization, starting with Jane Henniger, who is the current executive director of the ACLU of Indiana. Jane, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
It's good to have you here. Gil Holmes, who is the immediate past executive director. Gil, it's good to have you here.
Thanks, John. Thank you for having me.
And Sheila Kennedy, who I know, preceded me as the executive director of the ACLU of Indiana. Sheila, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I think probably the best way to start this is, Jane, we do have a birthday here,
right?
And that generally involves parties of some kind. So could we talk about how the ACLU of Indiana is marking this occasion?
Right. Well, we're celebrating our 60th anniversary as an organization in Indiana. Of course, the national organization has been around more than 90 years, but it was 60 years ago that we founded an organization here in Indiana, and it was 70 civil libertarians who got together from all parts of the community in Indianapolis and started watching out on behalf of their fellow citizens to preserve their rights and freedoms. We're celebrating all year long, so maybe it's a year-long party. And
sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah. And we're doing it both by incorporating our anniversary and the history that it entails in our regularly scheduled events, as well as doing some special stuff. So in the special category, last month we had a return to the Indiana War Memorial. 60 years ago, when those civil libertarians got together, they tried to have their first meeting at the Indiana War Memorial, and they were denied. Even though it's a public venue, they were told that they were not, their views weren't acceptable to the powers that be. We fought that for, what was it? 25 years in order to finally get our way back into the Indiana War Memorial. And
that first meeting was documented in an absolutely wonderful Edward R. Murrow
program
titled An Argument in Indianapolis.
Right. And when we actually finally got in decades later, Fred Friendly and a couple of other famous broadcasters came to help us celebrate that victory of free speech and assembly. Every month we have a First Wednesday program, every other month. More often than not, they're hosted right here at WFYI, and we've been doing that for years in different venues across the city. we're going to every month incorporate a topic that demonstrates the depth of our history. And next month, we're doing something special. June 5th, the first Friday in June, we're going to be meeting at the IMA because we're going to be in the evening at 6 o'clock on June 5th. And we're going to be talking about art as dissent in celebration of the Ai Weiwei, a visit in Indianapolis. And Ai Weiwei is a controversial dissident artist from China. And it's easy often to talk about other countries' suppression of civil liberties, but it's something that we have to fight every day here in the United States. And that's what makes our democracy so vibrant, that we have a constitution that provides for those liberties, but we always have to point out and make sure that the spirit and the letter of the law is being followed.
We are talking about the 60th anniversary of the ACLU of Indiana here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I'd like to ask, I'll start with Sheila. What path brought you to the ACLU in the first place? Because I think all of us had careers before we came to that job. It's there is really no normal or typical path to it. What
no,
brought
there
you
isn't.
There?
Well, I had been practicing law, and to be really candid, I was pretty bored with the practice of law. And I remember sitting at my breakfast table one morning and seeing that the position was open. And I remember saying to my husband, I think I'm going to apply for that. And he said, what does it pay?
That's a spouse's question.
Yeah, and when I told him that, he blanched, but the children were out of school by then. And so I ended up taking, I think, a 50% pay cut or more. But it was never boring. I'd been a member for a long time. And I do recall that the headline in Nouveau, in red ink, no less, when I was appointed, was ICLU taken over by card-carrying Republican, because somehow there's a variety of misunderstandings about what civil liberties are and what the ACLU is, and it was evidently considered to be a scary left-wing organization, and the thought that they had hired someone who had been a Republican candidate for Congress seemed evidently very incongruous to them. But it was a fabulous job, and I enjoyed
still
every
is.
Minute. Yes, it is. But it's also, it takes some energy.
Gil, what brought you to the ACLU, the job? I think you probably have the most interesting story at the table here.
Well, I was a board member at the time. But let's backtrack a little bit, John, to how I became a member of the ACLU. I was a late law school attendee. At the time, I had some responsibilities with the state and a job that was pretty crazy. And I was recruited at 30,000 feet between Indianapolis and Denver on an airplane by a guy named Hamid Kashani,
mm-hmm. whom we all know.
I was reading a torch book or something, and he says, "Are you a lawyer?" I said, "No." I said, "I'm a law student." He says, "Are you a member of the ACLU?" I said, "No." He said, "You should be. And here's the form, and just give me $10 a year."
That's
30,000 feet. So that's how I ended up, that's how I became involved. But what I discovered was I probably should have been involved all my life because of the issues that the ACLU certainly was always representing and trying to get done. So I became a board member. And then after a bit of turbulence in this position, I had reached a point in my life when I was going to do just some consulting and maybe retire. And you will recall some of those conversations.
Yeah.
And I was asked to help out with the organization. There was a little bit of dysfunction in various places, the board and
the ACLU dysfunction. That's
yeah,
hard to
some
believe.
of that.
Yeah,
typical organizational stuff. So, yeah. I said, "Sure, I'll help you out. I'll take you as a client," because I had started a consulting practice, and it was going pretty well. And then that ultimately led to, "Well, will you become the interim executive director?" I said, sure, while you find a search, 6 months, that's it, I'm out of here. Well, that, as you know, unfolded in a different direction, and I ended up being the executive director for 4 years. As Sheila has said, and as others, I'm sure yourself is one of them, mm-hmm. to say, it was probably one of the most rewarding experiences of my life in many, many ways. First time I had never had a secretary over in 35 years, and or a full staff. So that was different. But the main thing was we were doing good stuff that needed done, and certainly the challenges didn't fail to continue to come from the Indiana legislature and other places that allowed us to continue to serve the people's needs in Indiana. And so that's the short story.
What did you like most about? I'm going to stay with you for a second, Gil. What did you like most about the job?
What I liked most about the job was really being able to support a very small but very dedicated staff and make it possible for them to do their jobs better and to, again, be able to really provide some necessary support, counsel, and representation for people, organizations and people that were really being steamrolled in our state.
Sheila, how about you? What did you like most about the job?
I think I really liked best the ability to... any organization, and especially the ACLU, does give you a platform. And as you know from my prior visits here, civic literacy is something that matters a lot to me. The fact is, so much of what the ACLU does and the misunderstanding about what the ACLU does comes from the fact that very few Americans really understand our Constitution, our history, our form of government. And so the ability to engage in a lot of public information, public education on the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, what we mean by saying, you know, you have a right to free speech. I don't want to divert, but there was a kid who called me when I was executive director and said he wanted to sue White Castle because White Castle had violated his freedom of speech. And I said, really? How did White Castle do that? Well, they didn't hire me because I was tattooed all over and I have a right to expression. Well, yeah, he does, but not against White Castle. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got a right not to be suppressed by government. If the city council passed an ordinance that said you can't be, you can't get tattoos in Indiana, then that's a civil liberties violation. What he didn't understand is that, and as I told him, White Castle has constitutional rights too, you know? But those kinds of misunderstandings, very basic misunderstandings, I really liked our ability to get out and try to explain to people what civil liberties are and that, you know, your rights are not rights against your mother or your employer necessarily, they're rights against the government.
We are talking about the 60th anniversary of the ACLU of Indiana here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can shoot us a question or a comment via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I can switch to the present tense with you, Jane. What do you like about the job?
It's I totally agree with Sheila and Gil that it's a fantastic job. And if you believe in our democracy, if you believe in the beauty and potential of the Constitution, and this is usually the point where I get all choked up because it's sincere. Then, you know, who wouldn't love this job? You are pushing government to fulfill the potential that the Constitution has created for it. It was a genius document. It's been interpreted with a little, you know, bumps in the road. But you know, we have an incredible guidepost for our society. And our job at the ACLU, which is unique, there's no other organization that does what we do. We hold government accountable to the potential of that document. And the whole world looks up to what we've done. And internally, we have a standard to uphold. And to play a small part of that is a joy. I'm curious, you know, how you felt as a journalist working in this job.
Oh, well, I love doing the work there. And I'll apologize to the audience. They know normally I ask the question, but that's okay. But I would say one of the things that picking up on this, you know, it sounds like we all approached it slightly differently. Some of that was dictated by the time and the challenge, the things that the organization needed. One of the things I thought that my training as a journalist allowed me to bring was, the ability to explain not just why something was unconstitutional, but why the Constitution was a good idea.
Right.
We're going to continue talking about the 60th anniversary of the ACLU of Indiana. You're listening to No Limits. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today, marking the 60th anniversary of the founding of the ACLU of Indiana. My guests are Jane Henniger, who is the current executive director of the ACLU of Indiana, and my fellow former executive directors, Gil Holmes and Sheila Kennedy. Again, I'm going to acknowledge that I am part of the club here and am a former executive director of the organization, so we're not withholding anything from the audience. We were talking about best parts of the job or the things we liked about it. What and Sheila, I think, in particular, has alluded to a lot of the misconceptions of what the ACLU is. Jane, could you speak to that a little bit? What do people not get about the ACLU that they should?
I think the biggest misconception stems from when people confuse the positions and views of our clients with our positions and views. So Roger Baldwin was one of the founders and the longtime head of the National ACLU, and he said best, I think, when he said, we only have one mission, and that's our own. And that is to assert and protect constitutional rights and liberties. That's it. So we may do that on behalf of a whole range of individuals that we're asserting their constitutional rights in whatever manner doesn't mean that their mission is our mission. So, and I think that's the biggest source of confusion. We're not necessarily a liberal organization. We're not necessarily a conservative organization. We are nonpartisan. We are dedicated to preserving and protecting constitutional rights.
Sheila, where do you think that misconception springs from, though?
You know, I was nodding vigorously when Jane started that, because that was, I mean, people have a tendency, if you are asserting your right to free speech and you're a Nazi or a communist or whatever, and the ACLU says, hey, you've got a right to say whatever it is you're saying, for some reason people think, oh, well, the organization agrees with what you're saying. We don't necessarily. We might in some case. But the point is, what we're agreeing is that you have the right to say whatever it is you wish to say, not that we necessarily think what you're saying has any merit. But for some reason, I think people do have a great deal of difficulty separating out the notion that what the organization is protecting is your right to speak, not your point of view.
Gil, does that create difficulty? I mean, you know, the ACLU, and I can say this having been in the chair, too, you know, there are times you end up representing or trying to help some people whose hands you're reluctant to shake. Does that create some dissonance?
That does. I think, John, although for those who practice law, they would argue to that mm-hmm. that can always be the case, that you have a client that you would rather wear
protective gloves, surgical gloves,
and shower after the meeting. But just to follow on to what Sheila and Jane have just said, one of the very big points I think that has cast an unfair shadow over the ACLU has been people's abilities to confuse the issue of religious freedom. Mm-hmm. and cast the ACLU as being anti-religious. That has often played out, and it still has an impact locally as well as I'm sure nationally in terms of how various segments of the community respond to our interest in helping to represent them in terms of the Constitution and the real nut of the Constitution. But people really have a lot of problem with the whole issue of religious freedom, which is what the ACLU is about, among other things, as opposed to being anti-religious, which we are not.
We are talking about the 60th anniversary of the ACLU of Indiana here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly, certainly. What's on your mind?
It just seems some of the misperceptions of the Civil Liberties Union is that they take unpopular views, often minority views. And in a democracy, many people automatically believe that the majority is right. Mm-hmm. That's how we vote for presidents and everybody else. But it's kind of the opposite when it comes to the Constitution, that it protects the views and rights of minorities, even if they're unpopular.
Thank you very much for the call, John. Yes, Jane.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, John. And in fact, I mean, the fact that there are misconceptions about and misunderstanding of ACLU's mission is why we exist. You're absolutely right. I mean, the power and beauty of a democracy is that it's majority rule. The danger of a democracy is that it's majority rule. And James Madison, who was the principal proponent of the Bill of Rights, when he was arguing that the Bill of Rights should be adopted, his argument was, we have a democracy where majority rules. We have to have mechanisms by which to protect the minority view. Sometimes the minority becomes the majority, sometimes it doesn't. But we have to have a way so that the majority doesn't overwhelm the minority and infringe upon those rights. So you're absolutely right that the likelihood of that misperception is built into our democratic DNA.
And I'd like to add something to that, because the ACLU, I remember a friend who said, you know, if you guys just didn't take such controversial cases, or if you didn't, it didn't adopt, you know, it didn't represent people who are so unpleasant. That's the problem, mm-hmm. is that in a country where the majority does generally rule, the person who is expressing a popular point of view is highly unlikely to be silenced. It's the guy who is very unpopular, the guy that we want to wash our hands after. I remember when I was first executive director, and we had hardly any staff at all, we ended up representing the Klan. And mm-hmm. the guy came into the office to sign a pleading, and I mean, he was just exactly what you would expect, big belly over this buckle and dirty and yucky. And there was our African-American secretary, our gay cooperating lawyer, and me, Jewish, who were representing this guy who would have killed us all if he'd ever gotten into power. But the point is, we all understood that if he doesn't have the right to speak, ultimately, neither do we, because mm-hmm. you don't have a right if it's just a privilege. So, yeah, there are a lot of people that we don't like very well whose rights we have to support.
What was the most difficult issue for you to deal with the ACLU? Because we are dealing with things that are unpopular, mm-hmm. it can be tough. I mean, there is some soul searching that goes into it. Gil.
There were several. I'm just going to pick out one, I suppose, that was of interest, which was a case, a local case, and it was a school prayer issue,
mm-hmm.
and we represented the student who was adamant about not wanting to mm-hmm. To participate in that program, for good reason. At the same time, part of it was maybe that student's attitude, and the way the whole thing was presented, it made it a little bit distasteful.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a case that was a righteous case, and it ended up prevailing and changed the patterns and practices of the school system that was involved. So I suppose that was just one. There were probably others as well. I had a similar run-in that Sheila mentioned with a fellow from Southern Indiana who clearly would not have chosen me as a friend, but wanted to make sure that he was being taken care of because his rights to speak his mind regarding white supremacy were being denied.
We are talking about the 60th anniversary of the ACLU of Indiana here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Marion, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi, Marion. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you. I'm a nurse and health educator. I live in rural Indiana. In the last few months in the Congress session, those of us who, Hoosiers Environmental Council, Indiana CAFER Watch, the Alliance for Animals, and Hoosiers for Humane Animal Agriculture worked real hard to defeat these right to farm, right to hunt, and right to ranch bills. And, you know, I try to grow organically, but I can't because now we're totally surrounded by desecration of our land. I mean, go in, flatten the hills. And also, our county has no say. We really have no say if a pig farm's built across the road from us. And at the meantime, at the State House, they're trying to take away the county's ability to, I mean, we're trying to get a ban on a county level. Meanwhile, the state's trying to take away the county's ability to decide against common animal practices. And, you know, I've been advocating for about my whole life. I'm a vegan, but, mm-hmm. you know, we really, those of us who advocate for the earth and animals have absolutely no voice. And these gag bills gave us a voice, which was wonderful. And a lot of, you know, Millions Against Monsanto and all these people have joined together. But is there any way you could help us give more of a voice for the earth and the animals?
Good question. Thanks very much for the call, Marion. Jane, I think since you're the one who's on the clock now, we'll
right,
let you take
right.
that one.
Well, as Marion probably knows, there was an effort to gag whistleblowers of some of the practices that animal lovers and just people, you know, who are concerned about humane treatment and the quality of our food. It was called the Ag Gag Bill, and it had a couple of lives or iterations as it made its way through the General Assembly. It ultimately was defeated or died, but in its final last gasp, it was so outrageously unconstitutional that it would have failed in a moment. And its final, in its effort to prevent people from going onto farms, taking pictures, highlighting unethical or other bad practices, it sought to criminalize any acts, an overt act that was intended to harm the business. Of course, that was intended for farms, say someone going on and showing that they had 100 chickens per square foot or something. But in the way that it was finally drafted, it would have criminalized everyone who goes into a restaurant, takes a picture of the lousy cheese sandwich that they just bought and they posted on Yelp or their Facebook and say, this, you know, this, never buy a sandwich from this business. So it was wildly overbroad. And, you know, the Ag Gag here was part of a similar effort across the country to put up protections of industrial agriculture and other industries that infringed on civil liberties and just the free exchange of information by the press or by citizens. You know, and that's emblematic of so many of the battles we fight now they're part of national campaigns, whether it's this bill protecting industrial agriculture or bills on immigration or reproductive rights. They're not just an isolated bill that gets introduced to our General Assembly. There are similar bills all across the country, which is why, as part of a state affiliate, of a part of a national organization, we can work not only here in Indiana, but as part of a united front across the country to combat those that creep that threatens our civil liberties.
Well, there were people, you know, since I spend a fair bit of time these days at the State House and am connected, there were legislators who were saying that bill is unconstitutional. I want to broaden the topic here a little bit because this is, I think, one of the misconceptions of the ACLU. And I want to disclose again, I am a former executive director. This is not the typical format for the show. That I remember when I was in the chair, one of our big issues was that the state wanted to post the Ten Commandments on the State House lawn. And I was over there quite a bit. I had to register as a lobbyist in my time there and spent time dealing with that. And there were legislators, some who voted for it, who were running around as a kind of private joke and referring to it as the ACLU. Well, actually, it was at the time the ICLU appropriations bill because they knew, you know, we were going to sue. They knew we were going to win, but they did it anyway. Mm-hmm. Sheila.
John, let me piggyback on that because this is something that drives me crazy. I had a student at the time, I was already teaching at IUPUI, and I had a student in my class who was a representative, very bright guy. He came in to talk about his paper, and I said, "You voted for hanging the bill of, hanging the Ten Commandments on government buildings." I said, "You know better than that." He said, "Well, yeah, but, you know, the people down in Mayberry, where I come from, wouldn't understand it and let the courts bail me out." You know, I was livid because that, to me, is an abdication of his responsibility. You know, all of our elected officials take an oath to uphold the Constitution. Many of them, as we can tell, don't know what the Constitution is. So, you know, they do stupid things. But this guy was bright and knew better. There is a tendency of, especially, I think, more rural legislators who don't want to have to explain hard votes back home to say, well, I'll just let the courts bail me out. You know, I'll let them overrule this thing that I know is unconstitutional. And that is very troublesome.
Yeah, I think the other parallel, and we were talking about, for example, the Klan. I remember when I came in as executive director, there'd been a series of near riots when the Klan had rallies. There'd been one over at the State House on the west side of the building that had gotten out of hand and all of that. And several of the Klan members who had gotten fairly savvy about this and figured out, okay, all we have to do is announce we're coming. Everybody will say we don't come. We get, you know, a bunch of earned media out of this exposure. We get a much bigger crowd than we could ever hope to build on our own. And I remember getting a call from a small town mayor. I'm gonna protect him because he did the right thing here. He called me and he said, Klan said that we want to come, we want to have a rally in your town. I really don't want that kind of trouble in my town. Is there any way we can avoid this? And I said to him, issue the permit. Don't do a press release. Don't shake your fist at them. Don't do anything. Make them build their own crowd. If they have to do it themselves, they'll have difficulty filling a phone booth. Mm-hmm. But if you help them, you're going to have, you know, every bigot in a three-state area there. Result is he did it that way, and they didn't come. They ended up not coming, which is one of the issues. We are talking about the 60th anniversary of the ACLU of Indiana. Here on No Limits, my guests are Jane Henniger, who is the current executive director, and former executive directors Gil Holmes and Sheila Kennedy. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today. We're marking the 60th anniversary of the ACLU of Indiana. My guests are Jane Henniger, who is the current executive director, and two other former executive directors, Gil Holmes and Sheila Kennedy. Again, to disclose the audience, I'm a former executive director of the organization as well. We were talking about misconceptions about the organization, and I think this is one, obviously, inside the clubhouse that we can talk about. How much does the ACLU play into that itself? I mean, in helping to kind of foster those misconceptions? Sheila, you're shaking your head, so I'll go with you first.
I'm always shaking my head, John. but, no, I think that may vary from state to state. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it'll vary with the personality of the executive director, as we all know well. I mean, some people are pugnacious, and they sort of like to pick a fight. You know, everything is outrageous. Everything is this. In Indiana, at least for the past many turns of the chair, if you will, I don't think we've done that. And I think
it's been a pretty buttoned-down affiliate for the past.
Well, and we're pretty much what I used to call a core civil liberties organization, which means we basically only sue the government. There may be, as I say, affiliates that do that, but I think they're rare, and I do think that when something like that happens, it gets lots more publicity than the day-to-day doing our job kinds of things that most of the affiliates and their staffs do.
Jane Henniger.
Yeah, Jen, I think that part of the problem, too, is that people pay attention to what the ACLU is doing when they care about the issue that we're working on. And so they only hear about and focus on that issue. And when we talk about it, we talk about it in those terms. You know, we don't always, we can't always talk about this is like it's a civics lesson that this is about the Constitution. We have to talk about the fact that we're protecting prisoner rights, or that we're protecting free speech, or that we're protecting reproductive rights as defined and by the Constitution and court decisions. So in part, it's just the human nature of people pay attention to us when we're talking about something that they have an interest in, and depending on where they fall on that issue, they agree with us or they don't agree with us. And then again, you know, we can only talk about the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment so many times. We've got to talk about the facts of the case, and when we start talking about the facts of the case, then it people only hear those, and they don't hear about the constitutional underpinnings that have motivated our involvement to begin with.
I guess where I was coming from in that conversation is one of the things that I found over and over again when I was the executive director is I'd go to an event, and, you know, I'm a fairly relaxed presence. and, you know, people would say, gee, you're not angry. I would expect someone from you guys always seem so angry all the time. Gil, you're a very relaxed presence, too. and I'll say that, use the we, because I am part of the club. Is one of the ACLU's challenges or problems, maybe we could smile a little more than we do?
Well,
we're all smiling now.
Yeah. Perhaps that's true, but the underlying truth, I think, John, is that we represent unpopular causes, mm-hmm. Always, and they're really very heavy and unpopular causes. Mm-hmm. I mean, who wants to come out and wave the flag for the rights of prisoners who are already incarcerated, who've already been, you know, done something?
Or child molesters.
Yeah, Who wants to make sure that they aren't unfairly on the child molester registry? I mean, the kind of things that we do are unpopular causes. So the question is, how can you, if you're representing that, how can you put a smiley face on it because it's an onerous issue? At the same time, you don't want to be a flag-waving zealot and be out there, you know, this is unconscionable, we won't stand for it, and that kind of thing. I mean, just do what we do. And right. And I think that that in many ways presents a challenge for us in terms of support from the larger community to find the key to that. Most often, I think our successes come with a particular issue that someone is excited about or some small group is excited enough about to want to become a supporter of the ACLU.
Yes, Jane.
Yeah, I just want to totally agree with Gil and to recognize it. I to this day, John, get those reactions. I had a root canal on Monday, and before my dentist would get started, he wanted to engage me on a civil liberties topic, and he premised it by saying, "Well, you know, I don't know if I should do this. We might start a knockdown, drag out fight. I don't have."
And you would say, "I'm at a considerable disadvantage."
Right. He was expecting me to be strident.
Yeah.
And I've gotten that reaction a number of times. Maybe I should do a little more self-reflection. But but in fact, people are always surprised and at how reasonable we are. And I also think it helps define the job for us. As Gil said, we just need to do what we do. And when we talk about what we do, we need to tell people not only what we do, but why we do it. And I think if we keep on saying that over and over again, then eventually people understand that as my board president says, we're the most patriotic organization in the state of Indiana because our job is to defend and protect the Constitution.
Yeah, I used to say when I was on the job that we would get into fights that at times I halfway hoped we would lose.
School uniforms.
But I said, yeah, I said, the point here is that the way our system is set up, it's an adversarial system. On one side, you're going to have the government asserting that it can abridge, curtail, eliminate a right. By definition, it's got to be some sort of private organization on the other side making the argument that it should not be abridged, curtailed, or eliminated. And, you know, if people get that and realize that it's about the process, about that a lot of the ACLU's function is making sure that the process works, that both arguments are being heard, they get it a little more. We are talking about the 60th anniversary of the founding of the ACLU of Indiana here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Mary, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I don't think you can celebrate the 60th anniversary of the ICLU without mentioning Bob Risk, one of the founders,
yes.
One who worked tirelessly to get us into the War Memorial Building for meetings.
And pretty much carried the organization on his back for a couple of decades.
Yeah, he did.
Well, thank you.
He has passed away in his late 90s, but I think we should remember him.
Yes, and in fact, at least when I was there, we had, thanks very much for the call, Mary, we had an award honoring Robert Risk that is one of the highest, if not the highest award that the organization bestows.
Right, and we owe our the organization's health today to the that foundation laid by so many people over the years who sustained it, if not by themselves, with Herculean effort in combination with not only hardworking people who are willing to donate their time and their treasure, but also, I mean, speaking of risk, take risks. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, we can talk sort of maybe even jokingly about how we're ACLU sometimes is unpopular now. It used to be more than unpopular. It could hurt your employment prospects. It could get a rock thrown through your window, as you all know. And so we do owe an incredible debt of gratitude for the people who built this organization.
That's one of the reasons, I think, actually, that showing the Edward R. Murrow See It Now program. Mm-hmm. If any of you out there have a chance to see that, it is worth doing because I've probably watched it 20 times now in my lifetime. I always find it moving to watch because, among other things, this is not all that long after the conclusion of World War II and, you know, the Korean conflict. And what you see, by and large, are veterans on both sides of the issue arguing over the meaning of what they fought for, which, it's sort of the ongoing discussion of America that I found found fascinating. Are there any plans to show the Murrow program?
No, but we have copies of the disc, and we are always anxious to find opportunities to share that bit of our history.
We have gotten a message from a listener who did not want to go on the air. It's from Ron, who was a volunteer for 2 years. Most impressed with how hardworking everyone is. So much work by just a few people. ACLU is really the only hope for prisoners and that others have. And says, God bless the ACLU.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Is that one of the... Kind. Is that one of the other misconceptions about the ACLU? I remember when I was there and we'd have the meetings, people would come into the building and say, is this all there is?
Yeah.
You know, they think mm-hmm. that it is this huge monolith yeah. out there that, Sheila, you're speaking the most emphatically, so I'll go with you.
No, I do remember my surprise when I became executive director. I mean, if you've gone through law school especially, half the cases that you study mm-hmm. in constitutional law were brought by the ACLU. I mean, you have this feeling that this is a monumental, you know, big, and then you find four people in a closet, and you're the guys who are doing all this. So there is a little bit of cognitive dissonance when you discover how dependent the organization is on those people that Jane was referencing, and you really appreciate. I mean, when I was there, there were women, elderly women who came in every week and took calls and did. That kind of volunteer assistance is just invaluable.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I discovered, John, when I started to be asked to come out to various places in the state and the community to speak about the ACLU, I would give them a rundown of what our caseload was like. And how many people there were to take care of that caseload. Mm. And they were always aghast. It was like, you're kidding me. Mm-hmm. You know, two lawyers and one paralegal and some little bit of administrative help taking care of these hundreds and hundreds of cases.
And these are not uncomplicated cases.
No, not at all.
They're the thorny ones. We are talking about the 60th anniversary of the ACLU of Indiana. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, or you can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. We have gotten an email question from a listener named Ann. Has the Indiana Civil Liberties Union ever challenged congressional redistricting in Indiana, given the obvious manipulation to benefit the incumbent party at the time of the census? If not, why not? And is it something that could be done? This particular problem deeply affects voters' rights. Jane, I'll throw that one to you.
Well, I'm not sure I know the answer, and I don't know if Sheila does. I mean, we have some redistricting cases now, but they're more adhering to the constitutional provision that it has to be fair and equal representation. So if two people are represented by one school board district member and 5,000 people by another, that's unequal. But I don't.
I think
there's a problem there with gerrymandering.
There's a huge problem, and the big problem is, and this is something that I think potential clients of the organization fail to understand often. You're bound by the case law that is in place, and the Supreme Court, and I'm talking about the United States Supreme Court, not the Indiana one, has been very, very reluctant to take on redistricting cases unless mm-hmm. there is a clear racial component. In other right. words, if they're trying to draw districts to disenfranchise a particular minority group, then the court will get involved. Otherwise, they have said this is a political issue. I think that line of cases is really wrong, but then I'm not on the Supreme Court. but again, you know, when somebody comes in and they want us to take a case, if all the precedents tell us that that case is a loser, that's something you're not going to be taking and wasting resources on, unfortunately. I agree with your questioner, but...
Eric, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Eric, welcome to the program.
Hey, so I had a question. Do you guys also deal with people coming from other countries into the United States? that deal with cases like that, with, especially with the issue of immigration now.
Thanks very much for the call, Eric. Jane, we'll throw that to you.
I don't think in the sense that you mean, Eric, we have had immigration cases, but those are more how we treat immigrants once they are here in the United States. We don't handle the process of immigration.
We've also gotten an email question from a listener named Jerry. I'm going to synthesize this, Jerry, because we're running close on time. Basically, says he appreciates the fact that ACLU represents both sides of an issue, but how does the ACLU decide which cases to take and which sides to represent? Jane, I'll throw that one to you.
Well, since we basically exclusively sue the government, which side is easy?
You're going to sue the government. Yeah.
And as far as cases, I mean, that's an excellent question because, as has been alluded, we have a huge amount of cases that come in.
And how many requests? I mean, it's some astronomical
number. Yeah, I mean,
often
it's as many as 800 inquiries a month that come in to our door. And it's decided by, I should say, our incredible legal director, Ken Falk, who is largely responsible for that impression that we have an army of lawyers,
yes,
because he is an army of lawyers in one lawyer. And he goes through all those cases personally and determines whether it's a case that is a civil liberties case. And second, whether it's a case that will affect more than that single
individual
plaintiff.
Yeah.
Right. So we have to make sure that we use our resources wisely. So we want to make sure that when we take on a case, it'll have as broad an impact on people's lives as possible. Because ultimately, you know, it's not about a piece of paper. It's not about the Constitution. Rights aren't sort of this ephemeral, hypothetical thing. It's people's lives we're talking mm-hmm. about. And so we want to make sure that we use our resources to impact the most lives.
We've got just a little bit of time, but the other part of Jerry's question is how, if people want help, how do they go about doing it, which would be a wonderful opportunity for you to drop
right,
the URL.
Right, so you can you can contact us via our website, which is aclu-in.org. You can, and I'm
go ahead
afraid
and
to say that
URL
I don't have my
again.
Phone number memorized. But you can look us up, our phone number.
It's 317-635-4059.
There you go.
Some things
are
drilled into your
yes,
brain
right.
after all these years.
I could have done that.
Well, I'm afraid that's the last word. This hour went very, very quickly. But I'd like to thank my fellow members of the club, Jane Henniger, who's the current executive director of the ACLU of Indiana, and former executive directors Gil Holmes and Sheila Kennedy. You have been listening to No Limits. I am John Krall. We will be back next week. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.